Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to another edition of Answers for the Family. I'm your host, Alan Cardoza, and for those of you that have been listening, sending in questions and comments, thank you so much, and please continue to help spread the word that every Monday from 11 a.m. to noon Pacific time, this show will bring on special guests that can inspire, educate, and in some cases, entertain, while bringing answers and options to making our lives happier, healthier, and more successful. Now, I want you to know that I really appreciate it if you could all do me a favor. Please forward one of our shows to your social media group and to someone that you know that can benefit from a particular show. It will help us reach more people, and we greatly appreciate it. Now, Answers for the Family will continue to address a variety of issues, from locating a runaway teen to family crisis intervention, building self-esteem, dealing with addictions, and creating greater health and happiness, and so much more. Now, we're going to introduce you to talented authors and new innovations in the areas of health, security, and fun for you and your family. Now, our topic today, for those of you that don't get our press release, revolves around Child Protective Services, or CPS, as they're referred to in the United States. So first, I want to share that I've had interactions with CPS over the years, and I've worked with many CPS caseworkers and investigators who have done a great job. And I could tell that they truly have a passion for helping families in crisis, and I feel that they've chosen the right profession. Now, I've also witnessed, and to take one case in particular, a CPS worker that advised a teenage girl multiple times that they didn't have to go with their parents or to a treatment center, that the CPS worker would stop that from happening if the teen said that she'd been abused by the parents. And she repeated this multiple times until the teen said it. Now, it was obvious to all present that it wasn't true, and she later recanted sometime later saying that she didn't want to go to a treatment center and that that just seemed to be the easiest way at the time. But the problem is the damage to her family lasted much longer. Now, our guest, Diane L. Redleaf, is the legal director of the National Center for Housing and Child Welfare in College Park, Maryland, where she heads the Redleaf Family Advocacy Institute and co-chairs United Family Advocates, a national bipartisan child protection policy advocacy network. Now, Diane graduated from Stanford Law School in 1979 and has led dozens of class action suits and appeals on the subject. She is the author of the new book, They Took the Kids Last Night: How the Child Protective System Puts Families at Risk, a book that vividly illustrates the constitutional balancing act where medicine, family interests, and child safety can clash. Diane, welcome to Answers for the Family.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to be on the show.
Well, it's great to have you. And I had a chance to go through the book, and I've had other people that have commented as well. It's a very provocative title for any book. Where did the title come from?
The title came to me in a flash just after over dinner, and it was about 2 years ago. So it wasn't sort of as, obviously resonating, I think, as it is right now, where we are, much more aware of children being removed by governmental action. We've had a big dose of that in the national media. But the part of governmental action that isn't told very much is the story of what happens when families are separated by Child Protective Services. The families tend not to speak out, and they also, are under-resourced with legal assistance and medical assistance in some of the cases that I'm talking about. So their side of the story has not really been told, but to answer your question, it is what I have been doing for a living, is helping these families respond when the kids are either at risk of being taken or have actually been taken. I'm sorry, I've got a little something in my throat just right now.
Well, now you mentioned the thing in regards to the national media, and again, you know, those of us here in the United States, we know that there's been an issue in regards to immigrant children being separated from parents at the border. So why is one headline considered news and the other one isn't, when it's taken from a family that has been born and raised here?
So I discuss that a bit in my book, because the main story I tell involves the family of a federal judge. And we actually tried to get media attention to the removal of the children at the time it was happening. Like, the police were out at the house. There was actually a stakeout at the house. And the father went to a news station. I was on the phone with a news station trying to get attention. And we couldn't get it. And the reason I think we couldn't get it is we couldn't prove at that moment in time that the parents were innocent. The media has been primed to sort of believe the allegations against parents. And so they are not going to take a side. And it was very challenging because I couldn't give assurances of their innocence. There was a doctor saying they suspected child abuse by these parents. So it became a challenge. So I think that's part of the different dynamic that happens with removals inside the U.S. and the removals at the border, because the parents at the border are not being accused of abuse of their children.
Okay. Now, and so what you're saying is that, you know, the media kind of goes into this with a, guilty until proven innocent sort of attitude. Now, you also say in your book that the CPS system itself assumes the worst and then treats the parents accordingly. Explain what you mean by that.
So there is a lot of immediate reaction in the child protection system. That is so. Anyone can call a hotline. Anyone can call a hotline. And they can even make calls that are, you know, motivated by self-interest to gain an advantage in a custody case, for example. But once the call is received, we have given enormous power to Child Protective Services to make split-second decisions that can have lifelong consequences for families. And they do that. And so on the strength of a suspicion alone, oftentimes families are separated.
Yeah. And I mean, on the one hand, I mean, we understand that, you know, part of our job is that, you know, we're there to protect the children, you know. So, at that point, you know, if there is a suspicion, you know, what is it that you do? How about when they make that decision and they say, okay, just to be safe, we're going to take the children out of the house. What happens then from the standpoint of parents or attorneys in regards to getting information and figuring out where they are or what the next step is?
Okay, so I'll answer your question, but I want to challenge the assumption that just to be safe, we should take the children, because that's not a safe decision for anybody, but maybe the caseworker.
No,
right?
And I agree with you. But what I'm saying, what I've heard from some of them, that's the terminology that they use. And I agree with you that it doesn't necessarily mean that it's necessarily safe. But in situations, as an investigator, when I've been involved, you know, it's sort of like, you know, why did you do this? That seems to be the continuing terminology that they use. But yes, I agree with you.
Yeah. So the book kind of dissects that quite a bit. And because I talk about the constitutional standard for removing children, which is supposed to be serious risk of injury plus an emergency situation. Otherwise, they should be going to court. Okay. Mm-hmm. If there's time to get a court order, they should be going to court and then making their case. So that's, you know, that's something that I just had to to stop you right there and say, but in terms of your question and what, you know, what do families learn? What access to information do they have? Very often, if they don't know where the child is being put in a removal like this, then they're not going to find out until there's a court date. And the reason I say that is that if the state has not placed the children with relatives, as they should as a first priority, then it's likely that the state has put the kids into either a foster home with strangers or a group home residential facility. And until there's a court action initiated, the parents are going to have a very difficult time getting information, even about what they're accused of, unfortunately.
You know, I just got back from a conference, and one of the seminars was based on trauma, you know, what causes trauma, and so on. And as the discussion was going on in regards to this, I ended up standing up and saying, shouldn't we be looking at this from the standpoint of there is trauma based on the deed that you do, but there's also, you know, and there's trauma based on not doing something, or there's trauma on doing something that is not even one of the first two choices. In other words, it's so if you take that same theory to this, you know, so what is the trauma, if any, that they have gone through? What is the trauma of potentially leaving them there? What is the trauma of taking them and putting them in a place with strangers? What's your thought on that? And how can that be reclassified in such a way so that better decisions can be made?
Well, one of the reasons I wrote the book is that the trauma that the children go through when they're removed and the trauma that the families go through, which is can be lifelong, actually, even if they're exonerated, there's some very long-term traumatic effects of having gone through something as horrible as having your children taken from you involuntarily and maybe put with strangers. First of all, you have to recognize that that's a harm. And unfortunately, I think our system has not tended to do that. It's tended to only look at what is perceived as the threat to the child in the home if they stay. And it doesn't even analyze that very well because, only in the most extreme cases is it, and those are hard to detect, but only in the most extreme cases is a child really in danger of immediate abuse such that you need to get into, you need to take the child right then and there without a court order. So my view is that, yes, you're talking about trauma any which way, assuming that there's a case at all. In the cases I'm talking about, there was actually, reason not to believe the allegations against the parents in the first place, and yet the children were taken. So that is just pure, harm that didn't need to happen.
Now, how about in the reverse? In this situation, when you have a family friend or a neighbor, that is witnessing something that they feel is inappropriate, and then law enforcement comes out, they talk to the parents and maybe the child, and then they decide that something isn't going on, that there isn't anything going on and they don't do anything. So what I'm saying is I think that we can have errors in both sides. What can we do to be able to be more accurate on these situations so that we are not taking kids when they shouldn't be or not taking them when they should?
So absolutely. I think accuracy is the goal. Accuracy is the goal. And the more information that can be gathered in the shortest reasonable amount of time to allow the best decisions to be made and then triaging so that cases get closed quickly, because what often happens, and what I've seen over and over and over again, is that there's a flurry of contacts that are made in the first day or two of an investigation, and then no follow-up for weeks and weeks until the deadline hits when this final decision needs to be made. So I also talk about like the source, common sources of information, and the states and local authorities tend to rely on a certain set of experts or consultants, and they don't really look beyond their immediate circle to gather, you know, a full range of information, including from, you know, doctors who might have direct knowledge of the family. And that's a big concern. So in terms of getting accurate information, it's essential to do intensive fact finding very as quickly as possible. But if there is no emergency for that child, then the option of removing the child should not happen without a court order.
You know, I was just thinking about as far as some of the statistics and things like that. I think it's possible that many of the people, again, because it doesn't get the publicity, many of the people listening may not fully understand how big of a problem this is. So can you go through some of the CPS statistics that are alarming to you?
Oh, absolutely. And they are truly alarming because as a result of laws and policies that require people to make hotline calls whenever they reasonably suspect child abuse, we have a lot of calls made, you know, under what I call when in doubt reporting, like, or see something, say something laws. And as a result, 7.4 million children had hotline calls about them in 2016. That's 10% of the child population. If they were, you know, different children, I'm not sure that they are, but that's the number of hotline calls. And they do get screened. About 40% get screened out, but the rest are getting investigated. So that's millions of investigations, about 4 million investigations in the United States every single year. You know, one study found that 53% of African American children had had a child protection investigation about them. The majority of African American children. So when you pare it down further, I mean, in terms, yes, there are cases that are extreme abuse. The numbers, fortunately, are a tiny, tiny fraction, like less than 1-2% of the calls that are investigated involve something that is, you know, life-threatening abuse. That's good. But how we're treating the 98% of people who are in contact with the child protection system, you know, in the name of preventing child deaths and, you know, very serious harm, you know, is really something that is of grave concern because we're causing a lot of this trauma. Now, another important statistic is that between 75 and 80% of the calls concern neglect, not abuse. And that is usually oftentimes associated with poverty. So when we think about the child, you know, the child protection system, we tend to think of heinous abuse, but that is really a tiny fraction of what the child protection system actually is addressing.
Now, give me that again. What percentage of the calls are actually for neglect?
75 to 80%.
Okay, because the first thing that triggers in me, because, yeah, I thought it was that, a huge number like that, is we need a different department, because if it's from a neglect, then it's very possible that what they need is help, not to take them away, but they need help to be able to you know, put them in a better position. So if we spent the money rather on somebody that's going to go out and take the, you know, cost-wise, if we're taking them and we're putting them somewhere else, there's a cost to take them, there's a cost to house them somewhere else, there's a cost for the court system to then decide what's going on, probably for a much smaller cost, you could just have people that go in to help them and go, what seems to be the problem? How can we help you to where you won't have to neglect them? Are they neglecting them because they can't afford a babysitter, and can we help in that area? Are they neglecting them because they don't make enough money to give them the appropriate amount of food? Can we help them there? To me, if you're talking about 75 to 80% of whatever the budget is that's going to that, if we reroute that into helping people, I mean, it just seems like a logical win-win situation. Am I missing something?
You're not missing something. You're exactly right. There is new federal law. We are cautiously optimistic that this might help, because the new federal law is going to channel federal money into some more prevention of removals and supports for families. So hopefully that will work and not just become another form of state surveillance, which is a danger in this, because if you extend, you know, a year long of services and supports, you might also be, you know, surveilling the family and, you know, could be resulting in more, you know, removals when maybe the children wouldn't have been removed had you not done that intensive, you know, involvement. But I don't want to suggest that neglect can't be serious. It can be. I mean, a lot of the substance abuse cases are in that category as well, and they could range from, you know, children who are in deplorable conditions. But at the same time, with the population of children who are actually removed and are subject to court proceedings, studies have shown consistently that 30% of those kids who are in the custody, you know, of the state and under court supervision could go home tomorrow if their families had housing. So it is really a issue of the allocation of resources and the misallocation of resources to not solving the real problems that families have.
Now, you mentioned earlier where you said that 53% of the African American children are being, I guess, investigated. Or the families are being investigated through CPS. Do you feel that this is a racial bias, or is this? I mean, why do you see this happening? What's the answer?
So, I mean, that was a lifetime assessment, so that 53% had some form of a child protection investigation. I think the reason it happens is possibly, you know, heightened bias in the reporting of incidents that might be not reported if the family was Caucasian, but also just fact that a lot of African Americans are in, you know, if they're lower income, they would be in contact with more mandated orders. I'm getting a beeping. I'm wondering.
I'm not hearing it. But
okay. I don't know what it is. I'm sorry about that.
It's okay.
That could account for the fact that, you know, they're under, you know, more contact with, like, welfare authorities, public housing authorities, and others who might make the call. Otherwise, I don't really know the reasons why there's such intensive scrutiny. There was one study some time ago of reporting practices at a hospital where they found that there was 11 times the rate of reporting for substance abuse for African Americans as compared with Caucasians in the same hospital, even though the rates of use were the same. So that was a disturbing.
Wow. You know, one of the things that I know that you write about, or, you know, that's in the book, you talk a lot about a strong support network, and you say that it's kind of the key to survival if you're dealing with anything within the CPS world. Explain why that is and how families can achieve that to get through it, so that if there's somebody out there listening and they're already in this system, what can you tell them that they can do that can help them get through it with the least amount of trauma?
So I think probably the most critical thing that a family can do, and not all families can do this, but if they can come to court with family members, if they can present family members who are able to step in, if they can get family members and friends to come forward to support them during visits with children so that they could, you know, have more time, you know, with the children who have been removed. I mean, these are all critical things that can change the trajectory of a case and support the potential reunification with the family more quickly.
Okay. All right. We are talking about Child Protective Services and how it's being used here in the United States. And so we are talking with Diane L. Redleaf. We're going to take a break right now. We will be right back. You're listening to Answers for the Family.
Founded over 30 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, West Shield has continually focused on resolving issues that negatively impact families and businesses. Our signature therapeutic transportation service helps to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely transported to specialized schools, programs, and treatment centers with unsurpassed experience and success. We are supported by our full-service, licensed investigation agency that has legally, professionally, and compassionately located hundreds of runaways and teens. We are experienced and qualified to help, offering solutions which may include referrals to our international network of top professionals in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, psychiatry, and investigations. Simply put, West Shield Adolescent Services and West Shield Investigations are the best solutions when your family is facing a personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. That's 1-800-899-8585, or visit our website at westshield.com. Thank you.
And we're back. You're listening to Answers for the Family. Our guest is Diane L. Redleaf. She is the legal director of the National Center of Housing and Child Welfare. And for any of you out there, if you have any questions, if you want to either email them in, instant message, feel free to. We have one that has come in, and this one reads, a few years ago, a dear friend who was a single parent had a horrific thing happen. Her 14-year-old son, who was out of control, began a blackmail campaign saying that he would call and report her for child abuse if she did not continue to give him money and literally, quote, keep your mouth shut, unquote, about his drug use. She went into the police station for advice on what to do, and they did nothing because he had not committed any crime. Her son was so angry, he did exactly what he had threatened to do. He self-inflicted some bruises, and she was arrested. And although she had a room full of witnesses, it cost her all of her savings to defend herself. And the judge still made her plead out, and she was labeled an abuser in the system. I'm so anxious to read your book. But what can anyone do in these cases when the judicial system is already stacked against you?
It's a terrible story. And unfortunately, I don't have an easy answer. I think part of the answer is to understand that we have laws and policies on the books that have encouraged this sort of rampant calling with no consequences, really no effective consequences, for the person who's trying to gain an advantage in this terrible system. And exoneration of the innocent has become even more challenging than ever. Part of the solution is to support the lawyers and the advocates who are trying to change the system. Some of the problem I talk about in the book is that our philanthropic institutions haven't really recognized the need for this form of advocacy very effectively. There are only a handful of the foundations that support this work consistently and at a high level. So that's part of it. But I think also this idea that, you know, we need to believe the child always has, you know, you could hear from that story that, you know, there's some obvious limits to believing the child, because children of all ages can have a whole lot of reasons why they're making statements that are untrue. So I think part of it is to credit the parent and to start believing, you know, that parents who are doing their best deserve support.
Well, I appreciate the fact that you brought up the part in regards to we need to make sure that we're gathering, you know, the right information. I mean, you know, as one of the things that you've already brought up, because I think that's essential, and especially in a situation like this. Now, for the listener that called in on this or that sent the message in, first of all, thank you for sharing that with us. But also, I'm surprised that because of the fact that she went to the police station ahead of time for advice, why there wasn't some form of documentation. You know, that would have been, I think, one of the best things would have been to have gone in and said, you know, or when it went to court, rather than being labeled, to be able to have this documentation that says, I went to the police station and I documented the fact that these threats are being made, so that when this, that when they actually follow through with it, you can go back and show something that's documented. So hopefully, if that will help this listener or anyone else out there, if you have threats like that, start documenting it with people in an official capacity, so that if it does happen, you can go back to that and show that there's a good chance that it's not true because of that.
Yeah, good point. You know, a lot of the advice I would give to clients of mine is to keep your own good notes. Don't count on the child protection authorities to keep good notes of everything you tell them. And in fact, you need to keep your own records, and so you can defend yourself. Unfortunately, I think people are naive and expect, you know, that when they say something, it's going to be properly recorded, but that's, you know, not always the case.
That's an excellent point. Now, and because, you know, what we're talking about now is that initiating, you know, this is how reports are initiated. In this case, it was a 14-year-old son. But for the most part, what initiates much of the child protective system's interventions?
So in our country, we have mandated reporting laws, and that's extended to the point that 18 states now have universal mandated reporting, which means everybody who's an adult is supposed to report child abuse or neglect. And, you know, but there's very little training on what that means. Well, in fact, there's almost none in some states.
Well, let me interject with a sort of a sub-question to that. When it's talking about reporting to who? And the reason I say that is that, so if you have somebody that is, you know, let's say going into treatment and the person makes an allegation, is reporting to the treatment facility, you know, so that, or is it reporting to, you know, the therapist, reporting to the police, reporting to Child Protective Services? In other words, at what point constitutes, you know, if you're going to tell every adult that they have to report, you know, it may be, you know, are you reporting to their parents? In other words, so if you have somebody that says, if you're a gym teacher and the child says that, you know, Uncle Bob touched me inappropriately. Now, at that point, is reporting to that child's parents adequate, or is that person mandated to a government official?
It's to a specific child abuse hotline, which every state has. That's the reporting requirement. And it started with professionals being obligated to report, like doctors and teachers. Those were the original mandated reporters. But that got extended in almost every state to just about every professional that deals with children. And in 18 of our states, that duty has now been universalized to all adults are supposed to call the child protection hotline if they reasonably suspect child abuse. The problem is, you know, we don't know what's meant by child abuse, and we don't know what's meant by reasonably suspect. So the result is that a lot of people are calling when it might be child abuse or it might be something else, or they just have a vague concern that maybe a child shouldn't be outside. You know, so we see here, I'm in Chicago, and there was a case involving a mother who let her daughter walk their dog as a routine practice of a habit of walking the dog around the block, and somebody called the hotline about that. So, and with these kind of vague open-ended reporting laws, that's the result. We get, you know, 7.4 million children being called to the attention of the child protection authorities in the most recent year that we have data for.
I know also, as you know, when I, you know, kind of looked into your background a little bit, and I noticed that you've been involved in this work for over 34 years. Share with us a little bit about your professional history and what made you, you know, how did this become your passion that you became so involved in this particular area?
So I went to Stanford Law School. I got a job with the legal services office in Chicago, which had a fabulous reputation as doing, you know, really cutting edge work. When I graduated from law school, that's where I went. I did some general legal services work for the first 2 years that I was there. Then I started working in the Women's Law Project, which was a downtown special project, and I brought cases involving child support, child care, child health, child benefits, and I noticed that all the cases I was working on behalf of women had the word child in them, and mm-hmm. the office I was working in didn't have a specialized children project, and it didn't have any work that was being done at that particular time involving the Child Welfare Agency, though it had a history of supporting that kind of work, but that had kind of gotten discontinued due to some staffing changes there. So I was able to convince the executive director of Legal Assistance Foundation to let me start a children's project. And when I started that project, I tell this story in the book. I wanted only to represent children. I had wanted nothing to do with representing their sort of, you know, parents who might have done bad things, you know, to the children. Mm-hmm. I was what you would call a child saver in my own head at the time. It took me one case to see that I was wrong in that. And it took me one law review article to read about why, and that was a law review article written by Professor Martin Guggenheim, who's one of the endorsers of my book. He's at NYU, and he's written extensively on parents' rights and children's rights issues in the child welfare system. So the case involved a child who had run away from successive placements where she had been put after she had been removed from her home. And the reason she had been removed is that her sister had made some allegations against a stepfather involving some kind of sexual touching. But the 10-year-old girl hadn't been making any allegations. She had just been, you know, separated from the family. And she had been put in successively further and further away places, to the point that she couldn't really run from where she was put. She was put out in a residential placement facility and couldn't run away anymore. Her family didn't know where she was. They didn't know how to find her. And they came to me. And since I only wanted to represent children, I said, okay, well, I'll represent her. And I took the family out there. It was an absolutely joyous reunion. One of the side notes that makes this story so indicative of how we've been removing children all along on, you know, with issues that are now coming to the fore with immigration is that the family was an immigrant family and they only spoke Spanish. So the child had been put in a place where there were no Spanish-speaking staff. So the child spoke English, but the parents didn't.
Yeah.
So anyway, I did this case in the year 1984, so quite a long time ago. So we came to court. I tried to get a hearing for the girl to be returned home, and I prepared her to talk about, you know, her understanding of the court process, which is what I needed to do in order to allow her to be heard. And she had a great understanding of the court process. She said, a judge is somebody who listens to you. Well, the judge refused to listen. Mm-hmm. So it was, a tragic experience. The mother had terrible representation. The mother was really more in the driver's seat than the child was. And I saw that had I been representing the mother, maybe I could have gotten somewhere. So that one case made me realize that really the parents needed to be represented in order to challenge some of the practices that were going on. And I've been doing it ever since then, since 1984.
Now, you mentioned in regards to that case that there had been an allegation against a stepfather. And I know that in many of these cases, there is that type of allegation. And it seems to be that the answer, according to the CPS, is to remove the children. And I've brought up in the past, why not remove the stepfather until such time as they can figure out what's going on? It's less trauma on the children. And granted, I mean, it isn't a pleasant thing, you know, for the stepfather to be removed. But at least at that point in time, I think you're in a much better situation in regards to the children who really are the innocent victims in most cases, are having as little trauma placed on them as possible. But just as you said, where there's, you know, there can be 3-4 children in a home and one child makes an allegation and they're all taken and put. And in some cases, when they're different ages, they end up in different places. So they don't even have their siblings. That drives me crazy.
Yeah. And then that particular case, what was also appalling and gave me a big dose of reality about how the system works, is there was one child who was left in the home who was a disabled child, and it wasn't because they didn't think he might be at risk, but because they didn't have a good placement for him, so they just left him home. So a lot of these decisions are not driven by, you know, genuine safety concerns, but by what, you know, their policies and protocols call for and what resources they think they have. You're absolutely right. The best solution is to remove the offender, assuming you have enough evidence that he is really an offender. One of the ways that case got resolved, and I'm not positive it was the right result in the case, but the 13-year-old accuser retracted her allegations. So we'll never know, you know, exactly the reasons she retracted, but that's what ended up happening. So the whole case really didn't have any, you know, positive outcome in terms of, you know, whether it was ever necessary to remove those kids.
Right. And when you talk about the long-term trauma, and again, as I said before, the trauma of choosing to do something or choosing to not to do something, what does that tell the, you know, the child who they were not able to place, that somehow, mm-hmm. if we thought as a government or whatever, that this was so dangerous that we had to take these other kids out, is it saying you're not important enough? You know, so I mean, that, you know, it's The whole thing just drives me crazy in the way.
And the splitting up of siblings, you're exactly right. I mean, that is a travesty, and it happens because we are overusing the foster care system and not tailoring the remedies appropriately to removing the danger and not the child.
Well, we have another comment and question that is coming in. And this one reads, it's always strange when I'm reading my own name, but this one says, Alan had a terrific show a few months ago with Dr. John DeGarmo about how children put in the foster care system are very vulnerable to human trafficking. How does this fit within what you are discussing? I read a recent article that human trafficking is a $32 billion business in the United States, and that a pimp can earn as much as $150,000 to $200,000 a year from one girl. It feels like these things are happening behind the scenes, and perhaps law enforcement may be turning a blind eye to this. What is your opinion?
So I think that the system has created a monster, and that we need to be putting a whole lot more energy into keeping families together as much as possible, because as soon as if you take a child out of their family, you have kind of eliminated what is usually the most effective advocate for that child, and you've made them more vulnerable. And especially if you don't have relative placements for them, the children to go into, but group homes, you know, and residential facilities have historically been a breeding ground for, you know, abuse and trafficking. So I think that the solutions are to shrink this foster care system as much as we can. And to do that, we need to be supporting the families in different ways.
I just had a thought. Is there any testing that's done to see if these children have abandonment issues or an attachment disorder prior to just making the decision to remove them?
Oh, almost never. No, I think. And studies, there's a famous study by MIT, Joseph Doyle, did some research that showed that children who were genuinely abused, and again, my book is about children who were never abused, but children who were genuinely abused still did better being left home than if they had been removed and placed in foster care. Because once you remove them and put them in foster care, you can have a series of removals that ensues. Because foster parents do not have the same level of rights to object to removals, and the states can make serial placements, and oftentimes children genuinely develop attachment disorder as a result of multiple placements.
Wow. Well, Diane, first, I just want to really thank you and acknowledge you for all the work that you're doing. You know, I'm just appreciative for the fact that you're out there. You're looking after all of our, you know, our children. And again, I just really want to acknowledge that and thank you for that. Thank you for coming on the show. Thank you for writing the book. Now, for those listeners that either want to get a hold of you or they want to get the book, maybe they're going through something or they have relatives who are going through something, where would you direct them?
So the best place to get the book is either through Amazon or through the publisher. The publisher is ABC Clio. And if you go on their website, you can order it, but it's also on Amazon. If you want to request a discount, you can do that through me, through my own website. I can send a coupon to anyone who's interested, and that's www.familydefenseconsulting.com. And that's also, my website is also the best way to reach out to me for consultation.
That's great. And again, for those of you out there, if you're driving and you can't write that down, we'll make sure all this information is on our website at answersforthefamily.com. So, Diane, again, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
All right. And for everybody out there, please be sure to put on your calendar and tune in next Monday when we will be joined by Rachel Cove and Seth Hall to discuss solutions for individuals struggling with addiction and how sometimes the obvious answer is the right one. If you get a chance, please visit our archives of past interviews at answersforthefamily.com, or you can subscribe to the show and it will be sent to you automatically through iTunes, Stitcher, or YouTube. If you like what you hear, please leave a review. It will help us reach more people, and we greatly appreciate it. If you'd like to receive our weekly press releases that let you know a little bit about our upcoming guests, please go to answersforthefamily.com. So until next week, be good human beings, be good to each other, and be with us again on Answers for the Family.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza, right here on LA Talk Radio.